Don't wait to buy real estate. Buy real estate and wait. Stay liquid so you'll never be in danger of losing the asset. And then the math is what the math is. Home prices appreciate at 5% a year for the last 70 years. And even in a big crash, they still bounce back to still be on pace for 5% a year.
Well, Jimmy Vreeland, welcome to Truly Passive Income.
Hey, Neil, how's it going?
That's great. You know, we were chatting right before we got started that I met you way back in 2017 at the very first Best Ever conference. I call it the conference that changed the course of my life, but I very vividly remember you and the strategy that you were doing at the time, and you're not doing it anymore, but you were very memorable back then. So it's great to finally get to talk to you again, my friend.
Yeah, I'm glad we can reconnect.
Absolutely. So, Jimmy, could you share with us the moment you realized that creating wealth wasn't about the conventional paths of fame or profession, but about buying assets? And how did this revelation guide you towards real estate investing?
I learned it in 2005 in Iraq. I used to be in the military reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And before that, it was always like, to be wealthy, you got to be like Steve Jobs, be a great entrepreneur or be an inventor or be a great athlete. And, you know, I had always dreamed and wanted to be a great athlete, but it just wasn't in the cards for me. But I had a ton of fun playing sports in high school and college. And then so I was like, cool, I'm just going to maybe do a military career, maybe be an average Joe. But building wealth, I didn't think it was on my radar until I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
It's a very common answer. I sort of read the book at the same time. It's not a nuts and bolts book. It's really just a mindset shift. I credit that book and the 4-hour work with kind of like completely rewiring my brain. Made me kind of miserable for a while when you're like still trying to figure out how to actually execute on it. How did you, once you'd had that shift in mindset, how did you then go about executing on that shift in mindset?
I don't know if you're familiar with the Kolbe test, Neil. It's a personality test. People like to learn by implementing, acting. They're fact finders, and then there's also implementers. But in this personality test, I am a 10 quick start. The only way I'm able to learn is by acting. And so when you're deployed, you don't have any expenses and you don't pay taxes. And I was getting combat pay. I was making for a 23-year-old guy, I was making a lot of scratch and I couldn't spend any money, more importantly. So I was sending all my money back to my mom and brother and buying rentals while I was overseas. I saw the concept and then just jumped into it. We didn't know what we were doing. It led to several family disputes that are kind of funny now, but that's read the book and bought some houses.
2005, 2006 seems like a great time to be buying houses.
And then when people complain about interest rates now, I'll never forget, like I was on mid-tour leave and me and my mom and brother were looking at houses. And now when I was born, my parents bought an owner finance house at 12%. And so my mom's like, rates are at 6%. They'll never be this low again. We got to buy now. It's all a matter of perspective, but like they were rentals. So we weathered through the crash and we still sold, you know, we held them for like 10 years, sold them, made $100,000 a pop. Like it wasn't bad.
Like people are kind of new to the whole real estate game. Don't realize that we've got sort of historically average real estate or average interest rates right now. This is not like historically high. The only thing that was historic was how quickly they went from low to high. And that caught a lot of people with their pants down. And that's a lot of what's happened. My first interest rate when I bought my first house in 2005 was 7.25%.
Yeah.
Which is essentially what they are right now.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. I did not enjoy 2021 and 2020 because I knew I was gambling. I knew this wasn't sustainable. So every time I hit the buy button, because I do a lot of wholesaling and flipping now, I'm just like, uh-oh, is this the one I get burned on? And then when those rates skyrocket, I got hammered on a few. So I prefer historically average interest rates like we're at right now.
So you have successfully navigated the transition from military service to real estate mogul. Can we call you a mogul now?
Now I'm just a dude. I love playing games and I love running teams. And I've been blessed enough to have that opportunity to do every day.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to call you a mogul. You can call yourself whatever you want. How has your military background influenced your business strategies, especially in terms of like team coordination and leveraging technology?
Me and my team, we got coached by a Navy SEAL called Larry Yach. I was an Army Ranger. And yes, it is a little painful to me to be saying, hey, my business and military wise, my two most influential people, I believe, are Jocko Willick and Larry Yach. So everybody knows Jocko, extreme ownership. When Jocko came out, I was just like, oh, I know all this stuff. Like, this is awesome. I didn't understand how exactly applied to civilian life, but Jocko does such a great job of showing it how it applies. And so we were able to hit the ground running and implement. because I got a bunch of veterans on my team. And then Larry Yach wrote a book called How Leadership Actually Works. And long story short for Larry, but he believes people are most successful and most happy when they're coordinating action with other human beings. It would take the course of this podcast to go through the syllogism, but essentially humans are most happy coordinating action with other people. Because, you know, I had this experience and Larry had this experience as a SEAL. You're in the worst places on earth, but you're happy. You're with a team and you're doing very hard things, very challenging things. And then he got out. He's doing easier things in more luxurious environments and he's miserable. What's the difference? He's like, oh, I was coordinating actions with other humans and it made essentially teaming with other people. And it's awesome. It's a ton of fun.
That makes so much sense. I think back on some of the jobs that I've hated. They've been bearable because I've liked working with the people. The job has been terrible. Retail, customer service, like the kinds of jobs that are just mind-numbing. And I've stayed with them for years because the people were cool. And there was this sort of common goal, not to compare it to combat or being in the military, but you often hear that, you know, when guys are in combat, it stops being about the greater world and just about the guy in the foxhole next to you.
Yeah, that would match my experience.
What's one thing perhaps from that book that you have been able to implement in your business that you think has really made the most difference?
Desired end state for every team member. Like I understand what their desired end state is. Like we don't wake up, me included, I don't wake up to serve my business. We got to make the business serve us. And so my team members, we all trade our talents and efforts. We trade amongst each other, trade with the business so that each individual can get to their desired end state. I love my property manager's desired end state. She wants to pay her house off. And now she's heard what I say about leverage. She's heard, but she wants her house paid off. And so she gets a profit share from the business without interfering with her privacy. I have a rough timeline of when she'll have that target done. But her desired end state, she shows up every day. She's got a great garden in her backyard. She loves that house. She wants it paid off. She wants it to be hers. And so what Larry shows is that you have to have a desired end state. And all humans do is get together, trade talents and services, and they help each other get to their desired end state. And so I know each and every one of my team members' desired end state. They know mine. And so that creates a level of vulnerability and authenticity that we all want to work together. And, you know, we're not going to let each other down.
When you say desired end state, is that desired end state in their own personal life or within the company?
Both. So we have a corporate desired end state and we have a personal desired end state.
Got it. And how often do you guys review those kinds of things?
Every week at our weekly L10, we run on EOS. We've mashed and mixed together SEAL team leaders and EOS.
So when I first met you, your company, you were doing lease option sandwiches. We were in the height of the Great Recession. Well, not the height of the Great Recession, but we were still on the tail end of the Great Recession. We were kind of coming out of it.
We were coming out of it. Everybody was still scared.
Yeah. Everyone was thinking real estate was still kind of scary. So what are you doing now? You said you're doing turnkey, correct?
Yeah, we do turnkey and your passive investors will love this. Turnkey and we call them Burkeys and creative deals, passive creative deals.
And in particular, you were based in St. Louis, as I recall before. Are you still in St. Louis?
Yeah, St. Louis and Little Rock. We are expanding to Little Rock this year.
Your home base is St. Louis, but the markets you're doing are St. Louis and Little Rock?
Yes, sir.
Got it. So what, you know, the average turnkey... My one issue with the typical turnkey is that you're buying the future cash flow and you're buying the future appreciation, but most of the value add has been taken out by the operator. You know, they're the ones that found it. They're the ones who did the renovation and they're handing over a finished product to you. You've got a product out there that you call it a Burkey, correct?
Yeah. I mean, so we wholesale a lot too. I started doing the math and I'm like, wait, my local wholesale buyers, what do they want? They want a house that they're all in it, 80%. They'll flip it or they'll keep it as a burr. And then I had my out-of-state buyers, the turnkey buyers. And so turnkey is awesome. That appreciation with 5% a year and the rent increases, it's a great asset, but it's not a perfect asset. And here is the problem with every people building a turnkey portfolio. Any idea what it is, Neil?
I would say lending for the average person, that would just top of my head, is that a lot of people kind of run up against the lending limits.
You mean the 20 golden tickets?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah. So the reason turnkey really works is macroeconomic factors mixed in with other people's money. And so we can get into that. So what I found working, you know, we've turnkeyed around 800 houses, but I found like my best buyers, they buy like 7, 8 for me in a year. They're like, I'm like, hey, it's the new year. You ready for another 7 to 8? Like, Jimmy, I'm out of money. I don't have any down payment cash. And I want them to stay reserves. For their first 10, I think they should have $3,000 to $5,000 in a bank account. for each house, because real estate never fails, but the borrower's liquidity does. So you don't want to get your knees over your toes. Then I'm like, wait a minute, I'm selling all these wholesales to Bird Deals and to local guys. I'm like, why wouldn't I just sell these Bird Deals to my out-of-state passive investors? And so that's what we started doing.
So what does it look like for the typical passive investor? Do you have are you calling them up with 10 options of houses they can buy in Little Rock or St. Louis?
Well, I'm going to back up kind of a second. So the people I think we work best with are like high earning W-2s who are also generally business owners or sales. They know how to raise revenue, because the other thing I show people how to do is raise private money to then buy the BRRRS cash.
Interesting. All right. You buried the lead there. I think you were trying to get to it and I cut you off. So explain that to me further.
So I believe it's the only subsidy a middle-class American will get is a 30-year mortgage. If you're poor, you get a ton of subsidies. If you're rich, you get a ton of subsidies. It's the forgotten people in the middle. And so you can complain about it, or you can just look at the system and say, hey, what's out there for me? And a 30-year fixed mortgage, you know, if you buy a $200,000 turnkey, if you buy 20 of them, it's $2 million worth of leverage. And where else can you go and get $2 million worth of leverage? I believe every American has a patriotic duty to get these loans. And then after you get the 20, you know, do your syndications, do whatever you need to do, but got to get that leverage, really, regardless of the interest rate. And so everybody is going to most likely run out of their own cash. And so the other thing about most successful middle-class Americans is I believe they don't know how to fully leverage their W-2 by getting those loans. But then especially the sales community and the business owner community, they know how to raise money. They're just not raising it for themselves. I show them a few quick tips and tricks, and then they're able to raise private lending money and then start buying deals cash and then refining them out.
Well, I'm a syndicator. And so typically the kinds of people we're working with, they're already high net worth individuals. They're not typically middle class, although a few of our investors are middle class. And so one of the things I love about, and I always tell people if they're trying to get started in real estate, you're probably not going to get started buying into a syndication unless you're a doctor who's earning $400,000 a year already. If you're somebody who's just earning $100,000 a year, a syndication, it's going to take too long for you to save enough money unless you've been packing away money in retirement funds for you to make much of a difference. And I actually encourage people to start off. It's okay starting off in single family rentals. Like you said, that's where you're going to get the most leverage. They're going to subsidize you. As far as I know, there's no country in the world that does 30-year mortgages like we do. And that's one of the reasons our real estate is such a huge wealth builder.
Yep. And then another problem with turnkey, just being open and honest, is you'll run into a capital deployment issue. So that's where the syndicate, if you have a ton of cash to deploy, the fastest way you'll get that money to work is a syndication. I think we're discussing an order of operations type thing.
Totally. And that's kind of how I got started. You know, I mean, it was one of the reasons it was probably not such a great idea for me to go to that best ever conference in 2017, although I'm glad I did, because I went in and also, oh, syndications. Oh my God, I got to figure out how to invest in syndication. And then you start running into things like accredited investor. What's an accredited investor? Oh, I'm not an accredited investor and I can't do that. So how do I get to become an accredited investor? Well, I start building a portfolio of single family rentals. And eventually that's going to get to the point where the equity in that is equal to $1 million. And guess what? Now I'm an accredited investor.
And I've had a few buyers that's what they've done to get their accredited status.
It just takes time. And people, Americans are not so patient.
I had a funny discussion about this with my ads guy. So he keep pushing me like, Jimmy, get an offer that's like a microwave so people know they can make money right now. So, you know, I could teach a wholesaling course, which I don't want to do because I think it's boring. And then we can get into wholesaling a little bit. But I was just like, no, people who need microwave money, we will not work with. I don't want to do that. I'm not selling ketones. I'm not selling how to lose 20 pounds through a course with ketones. I'm selling a course about building wealth. There has to be a time horizon.
Everybody wants it to happen yesterday. And the reality is, you know, real estate's not a get rich fast, it's get rich slow.
Name one thing where you get wealthy fast.
Luck.
No, I mean, I would say like the lottery, you're rich, you're not wealthy. And the data on lottery winners is atrocious. Even like you could say, oh, Pat Mahomes, he's only 27. He got rich quick. Like, no way. I guarantee that guy's been, he was grinding since he's been 7 years old.
Look at Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift's a billionaire now who knew what she wanted to do at age like 8 and has been relentlessly pursuing it since she was 8.
What's the saying? Overnight success, 20 years in the making, something of that nature?
Yeah, something like that.
So, I mean, sure, anybody on the internet can make up anything to dispel that fact, or you could just accept it and get to work.
you're in the single family market, so you really have to have, and you're working in investor, you really have to have your eye on the macro economics in the market. I've heard you speak recently about these topics, so I want to broach it with you. Is it, how do you analyze the current real estate market cycle, and what indicators suggest to you where we are in the cycle?
I mean, there's one overall thing. There's no supply. The first, you know, four cycles of a market, the cycle before recession is hyper supply, and there's no supply. Our direct to seller business, like, it's fun, but we are getting creative on how we're getting inventory. Here's the math. There was 3 million houses available right before the crash in 2006, and there was 300 million Americans. Now there's 1 million houses available, and there's 336 million Americans. Like, everybody forgot to build houses as they were licking their wounds from 2008.
What do you think was the cause of that? Did all the builders just get wiped out, and the ones that didn't just kind of step back and said, yeah, we're not going to push it?
That's exactly what happened. Like, everybody was, I don't want to experience that again. I'm not doing that anymore.
Everyone, you know, there's so many people out there right now. I mean, I feel bad. There's a whole generation of people that are sort of watching the acceleration in the price of homes compared to their income, and it's outpacing it. And some of them keep waiting for, well, at some point, there's going to be a crash again, because I watched my parents lose their house in the Great Recession. So there's going to be another Great Recession, and real estate's going to drop again. I'm just going to wait for that to happen.
I've done some interesting math about waiting. So I did the math based off, hey, what if I waited for interest rates to drop or a crash? There's so much opportunity cost because of the financing, because you're using leverage, that waiting is generally not a great idea. You're not really going to save, because if everybody's waiting for rates to go down, most people predict that prices will go up. And so whatever saving in rate, you are now paying for in purchase price. And so it's just like, my philosophy on real estate is, don't wait to buy real estate and wait. Stay liquid, so you'll never like be in danger of losing the asset. And then the math is what the math is. Home prices appreciate at 5% a year for the last 70 years. And even in a big crash, they still bounce back to still be on pace for 5% a year.
You were showing a chart on a podcast I saw you on recently where it showed the number of years where there was a decline in home prices over the last 70 years.
Yeah, you want me to find that and bring that up?
Sure. I mean, yeah, go for it, man. Not many people watch the video, but it'll be great for me to talk about it.
I love this slide. You don't bet against the champ, Neil.
Bring it up, because, you know, I'd like it in front of you so we can talk about it. And it's almost like with the same thing with the stock market.
For those who are watching and maybe those who are listening, what I'm showing here is the median home price percentage of increase or decrease since 1941. And the reason you say don't bet against the champ, there's only been 6 years where the median home price in the United States has gone down. And 5 of those years were during the Great Recession.
I mean, so you're talking the little area with a nice long period of red in there. That's what, 5 years?
Yep.
And then outside of that, there was only 1 year. Is that what I'm seeing?
Yeah, you're seeing exactly correct.
You know, you got to be careful in saying, oh, well, you know, real estate only goes up. But the data kind of shows real estate mostly only goes up.
You can look at the other side of the coin. The American dollar is always going down because they're printing it. They're continuing to print more money. So I'm not sure if real estate goes up based off inflation. It still goes up, not always. But here's what I know. I know there's certain certainties. It's that the government will continue to print money. Like, there's nothing that's really going to ever be done about this inflation issue. It just is what it is. And so I don't know a better hedge than in real estate. The funniest thing for me in my rental portfolio is my 360th payment. I can't wait to pay the bank back in worthless dollars. Like, that's always amused me.
That payment is based on an agreement you made
30 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. This is close to politics as we'll get. You know, just looking at the overall way our government works, is I always compare it to, we're sort of like a business where half the managers want to just cut revenue and the other managers just want to raise expenses. And that nobody will ever really do what they really need to do, which is, as a business owner, you need to cut expenses and increase revenue. And you know they're never going to do it. There's no way. It's political suicide for either side. So we're constantly caught in this. Like you said, they're just going to keep printing money.
This is an idea I got from Ray Dalio, but I don't know if you've seen his YouTube video, How the Economic Machine Works. At the end of the video, like, the only solution to this is to become more productive. And that's a great thing about being American. Like, we are the most creative, you know, when our back's against the wall, we figure it out. And so it's like, all right, we're in a pickle. We're just going to outproduce it. We're going to figure it out. So that's why I'm generally always an optimist.
I'm in the same boat. I remember the first time my dad sat me down and taught me how to just invest in the stock market. It was just a mutual fund, all that. And he said, you know, a lot of people are afraid to invest in anything, stock market, whatever. It's like, oh my God, what happens if it all crashes? And he says, well, if it all crashes, you're not going to be worried about your stock portfolio. You're going to be worried about a lot more fundamental things than that. And it really won't make any difference. So like you said, don't bet against the champ, bet on the champ. And chances are you're going to win. And if you lose, then you wouldn't have won anyway, because the whole world has come apart.
Yeah. I mean, there's some major catastrophic things have to happen. That's why I really believe real estate works, is because here's why I think it's really hard to get wealthy with traditional financial planning. It's all on you. You're either tax deferred or after tax dollars. And I don't think you can get wealthy that way. Now, if you can learn to responsibly be a steward of other people's cash, the sky's the limit. And if you look at the wealthiest people, they're able to steward other people's cash.
My partner, Clint, and I often describe it as you have to play offense. You can't play defense. And you know, the traditional way of retirement, it used to be when they created the 401k and the IRA, that was supposed to be one leg of a three-legged stool. It was going to be 401k, Social Security, and pension funds. Well, as soon as companies started contributing to your 401k, well, they got rid of pensions right off the bat.
Right.
And I'm not as pessimistic about the future of Social Security as other people, but still, it's down to a two-legged stool. And most people have not done a great job of playing offense in their 401k, in their retirement funds.
I think it's a little bit designed that way because you're giving that responsibility to your financial planner or the corporate financial planner guy. And so I think that's another reason why I think you're seeing that phenomenon.
When you say giving responsibility, I mean, who are you talking about giving responsibility to? The average planner or?
Yeah, you're not doing your homework. You're not looking with these alternative investment classes, which are out there. They're everywhere. They're hiding in plain sight. But, you know, you just got blinders on, say, hey, I'll let my financial guy do it. And I'm sure they do a great job for what they're told to do or what their licenses allow them to do. I had never thought of it that way. Like, essentially, alternative investing, like you and I do, it's a third leg. So what should the fourth leg then be? Liquid savings?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially just cash. The whole financial advisor industry, I mean, not to knock them, but there's a couple of reasons they never really point people in the direction of alternative assets. One, because they can't sell them.
Well, their license is prohibited too.
Correct. And so they're usually, and they're paid often based on how much either commissions on you buying and selling those equities, or they're paid on your net worth of like how much money, assets under management you have. So they're not going to really be all that keen on you taking some of that money away and putting it into some alternative asset. I always tell people, look, invest in mutual funds. Sure, put your money in Vanguard Index 500. It's low fee, but set aside some money to play offense with.
I agree with that completely.
So given how severely short on houses we are in this country, how should investors adjust their strategy to capitalize on that scarcity?
That's a great question. Single family, like I said, I got rich in my niche, and so I'm not in multifamily. I don't know that much to speak that intelligently about it, but I think what's going on with single family is, remember how when you and me grew up, there was like Tom's hardware store on every town, right? And now it got institutionalized and Home Depot and Lowe's just institutionalized everything. I think if you buy now, you're on the ground floor of that in single family, of it becoming an institutionalized asset. And so 30 years from now, 10 years from now, when you want to sell it, you're going to sell it off as an institutional asset. And then part of me, since there's no inventory, like, get as much as you possibly can while they're still getting. Because part of me is like, as a turnkey provider, I might be put out of business because hedge funds are going to scoop everything up. I'll just become a wholesaler and sell to them. But the turnkey game could go away. We'll still manage properties and those properties will continue to climb in value. But it's the new inventory in the future that kind of concerns me the most.
And it's the concern is that we talk about this a lot, is we're going to become a renter nation.
So you got to get in on the high side of renter nation and be the landlord.
And unless there's some sort of legislative hammer that comes down where they try and at least stop hedge funds from coming in and buying up all the inventory, which I can't see anytime soon.
In my reading of American history, there's the man, right? Like John D. Rockefeller, Bill Gates, all those type of guys. I think the safest place to be is the level right below that guy. So you're not like a target for the government. Like when they took Standard Oil and made Rockefeller break it up, tripled his net worth. But they're like, we got the big guy. And he's like, okay. So that's all the hedge funds will do is like whatever's defined as a hedge fund, they'll stay a line below the hedge funds and continue to buy these assets. Because there's no other asset out there where you win in four ways: with appreciation, cash flow, the ability to use leverage, and tax advantages. And people know that and they want it.
What's your prediction on interest rates over the next 12 to 18 months?
I don't know. I don't care.
You don't care. Why don't you care?
Because you date the rate, you marry the house. I personally think rates going down will be horrible for investors. What I've been selling to people is like, hey, dude, once it goes below 6%, the funds are coming back in and then you're out.
Anybody who's been in, I don't syndicate multifamily, but I know a lot of multifamily syndicators, and that's how a lot of them got into trouble because rates were so low, they were having to compete. I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, 28 offers on a multifamily project, and they were having to basically just drop trowel to get in and just acquire the deal. And so then they start getting in these absurd rates and adjustable rate mortgages and things like that. And that's really where they got into trouble. And, you know, I'm in self-storage. We're kind of quietly over here in the corner. Like, it's not such an unknown asset anymore. And the rates, interest rates going up has certainly slowed us down a little bit, but it's also, there's not as much competition anymore.
When all this was going down in 2021, like, I thought it was awesome, but I thought, for single family 30-year fixed mortgages, it wasn't that scary. But for multifamily, you're looking for deal flow. Maybe you're a really responsible investor and you're running your numbers at a reasonable interest rate where the guy next to you is unreasonable. Sure, he'll default in 5 years, but he'll overpay and he'll get the project today because he's not running his numbers at reasonable interest rates.
Last question. Is there a lesson that you learned from either your father, your mother, or another mentor that significantly influenced your approach to business and real estate investing?
I'm very tight with both my parents, both of them, lots of lessons. But I think the story I like to tell the most is in high school basketball. I was a sophomore in varsity, so I thought I was super awesome. I thought my, you know, whatever didn't stink, and I wasn't getting enough playing time. And so, like, I was complaining to my mom, and I'm like, coach sucks. I'm not getting enough time. And she's like, whoa. She's like, you don't dribble well enough to play enough. And so she got me two chairs and a blindfold. And she's like, 20 minutes a day, you're going to dribble around these chairs blindfolded. And so my parents were this great mix of expectation, empathy. Like, it was a perfect masculine, feminine mix. I always knew I was special because of my mom. But like the fact that she didn't be like, yeah, Jimmy, that coach, he's a big meanie. So it's like a version, it's maternal extreme ownership. I like to think back to that moment and be like, I didn't get what I wanted. What happened? What could I do to get better? And so that's blindfolded basketball.
You got to put in the reps.
Yeah.
So what happened? Did you get more playing time?
Yeah. My dribbling got it substantially better. But if she had just told me I was special and you're the best, Jimmy, it would have created a sense of entitlement. I wouldn't have had as much fun playing basketball. So that's a great example, I think, encouraging parenting.
Well, I think we'll end there. Jimmy, I've so enjoyed this conversation, and I wish my partner, Clint, had been here to enjoy it as well, but he's off on a beach in the Dominican Republic sipping tropical cocktails, not that I'm bitter. If any of one of our listeners want to reach out to you, find out more about what you're about, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Probably LinkedIn or Instagram. So I think I probably pop up pretty easy. Jimmy Vreeland, Real Estate, V as in Victor, R-E-E-L-A-N-D. And then I'm coming out with a new website, but it's not up yet. So our website's vreeland-capital.com. And then I'm just Jimmy Vreeland at Instagram.
Well, Jimmy, this has been great. Thank you so much, man.
Yeah, Neil, I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much for listening and watching the Truly Passive Income podcast. If you liked the show, if you think it would be useful for someone else, the greatest compliment that you could give us would be to share the episode, leave a comment down below, or leave us an honest review. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to let us know down below. And remember, with truly passive income comes freedom of time, place, and the freedom to pursue your higher purpose.